This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with Twitter, where changes at the employer continue to unfold rapidly. More employees laid off last week, including some from the company's Boston office.
30 seconds left. We're all about to get fired from Twitter.
What's the thing?
I've been here 9 years and 9 months now. Same with you.
Right.
How long are you here?
4 years.
That was Matt Miller, who posted a video referring to his departure from Twitter's Boston office alongside several other employees on November 17th. Now, as of the 18th, the Boston Globe reported that the Boston Twitter workforce, once some 300 strong, had dwindled to a little over 100 employees, as measured by their presence on the company's Slack channel. As of 11 a.m. today, Radio Boston was not able to reach the Boston Twitter office to find out if that number further changed or even confirm that the office doors were open today. So much has been made of the social media implications since Musk took over. What about the leadership implications, and what comes next for users and workers here in the region? Joan Donovan is the research director of the Harvard Kennedy School Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, and Ari Waldman is a professor of law and computer science at Northeastern University and the faculty director for the university's Center for Law Information and Creativity. Joan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Ari, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
So Ari, I'm going to start with you, and this is not a rhetorical question. This is an actual question. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Well, certainly not in my lifetime. I mean, there have been companies and law firms that in response to economic changes have slashed their employee numbers. But this is unique in the sense that you have one of the richest men on the planet, who, by virtue of his lack of understanding of how companies operate or how Twitter operates, is essentially running this company into the ground as a passion project or out of a desire to feed his own ego. It's really hard to understand what the rationale is behind this, and I can't imagine what his investors are thinking.
So, Joan, I'll turn to you, and let me just hit a few headlines for listeners. So, Musk announces that he's going to buy Twitter, then he doesn't want to buy Twitter. Then there's a court case, so then he buys Twitter again. Then he lays off a significant percentage of employees. Then last week he announces that everybody has to come back to work in person, full time. Then he announces on midweek last week, anybody who doesn't want the new Cardcore Vision, take a severance package by Thursday. So lots of disruption, and that's not even focusing on the online platform issues that resulted from all of that, the failed change to verification, et cetera. You wrote a piece back in April basically predicting a lot of this. Has it panned out pretty much the way you thought it would? Worse, better, et cetera?
Worse in some ways, because I think the users don't really know where to go. And it's been this mad scramble trying to figure out, you know, how do you reserve all the work that you've done to build these very important networks for, you know, journalists and celebrities and politicians, because there's nowhere like Twitter on the net. There's just not a healthy replacement for it. In terms of Musk's motivation, though, Musk has been for a very long time now extremely anti-media. And so I was not surprised when he jumped in and made a mess of the blue check verification system right away. Was not surprised that he invited back Trump. I was not surprised with Kanye West's return. The only thing that did surprise me was that he seems to be holding the line at Alex Jones. And it's a very
of
personal
InfoWars.
Of InfoWars. So Alex Jones, who recently has been fined over $1 billion for content that he made about Sandy Hook that was untrue, that attacked the parents, that had significant impacts on their lives and their ability to just carry out their grief and move on with their, well, not move on so much, but, you know, have a normal life. Instead, Alex Jones had made them the center of this enormous conspiracy theory. But this is the one line that Musk is not going to cross, is to let Alex Jones back on. And he's alluded to this very personal story about having lost a child, Musk has, and this is the line for him. You know, the rest of us, I think, wish the line for him was hate, harassment, incitement.
Yeah.
Especially as we mourn the people lost in Colorado Springs this weekend. Hate has, you know, an aftermath.
So let me just set context for a few things that you just said. The Colorado Springs shooting was in a gay nightclub this weekend. President Donald Trump had his Twitter account suspended for inciting acts of violence relating to the January 6th insurrection. Kanye West, now had his account suspended for anti-Semitic speech. So these are the contexts in which you're talking about that. There's so much in here. Ari Waldman, at professor of law and computer science at Northeastern University. Let me turn to you for a second. Let's back up for a second. What if I'm a listener right now who says, listen, I'm not on Twitter. I don't care about Elon Musk. I don't care. People who are engineers in Boston who don't work there anymore are going to get another job. Why should I care? This does have reverberations well beyond people who rely on Twitter, either for community or work. Ari, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. There are so many reasons why people who are not personally, directly, or pecuniarily affected by this should care. Twitter was a cesspool of harassment and hate, particularly for marginalized populations, but it was also an important way for people to get their information out, for journalists to create community, to seek out experts, to connect in ways that weren't allowed on other platforms. In particular, Twitter was not perfect, again, but definitely more of a home for queer expression, especially since Instagram, Facebook, and other social media platforms disproportionately censored anything related to the LGBTQ community. The other reason why people should care is that there is a direct line between the kind of hate that is now accessible on this rump of Twitter that Elon Musk has created, and the kind, as Joan mentioned, and the kind of violence murder that happened in Colorado, the violence of people throwing Molotov cocktails and bricks through the windows of queer bars that host drag nights or libraries that host drag readings for children. There is a direct line. And it's not enough. And it's not enough for someone to say that, well, I was personally affected by X, and therefore I'm going to draw the line at Alex Jones. The fact that Elon Musk has shown absolutely no empathy, absolutely no interest in the effects of his platform on anyone other than himself and people like him, just shows how broken and bankrupt the Twitter community is going to be, such that now journalists, academics, any people looking for jobs, queer people, marginalized people, those living with disabilities, lots of communities, including justice movements across the world, use Twitter effectively. All of these groups are now without the tools that they have had for the last several years.
So Joan Donovan of the Harvard Kennedy School, as Ari lays that out, he starts moving us really into your wheelhouse in terms of your research of online hate, et cetera. I want to play a little bit of sound from a conversation we had here on Radio Boston last week with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of history at Boston College. We were talking about his book, Nazis of Copley Square, which looked at the emergence of the Christian Front before World War II. And he talked about the fact that actually, in some ways, the Christian Front was more powerful after it was forced underground. Here he is.
The Christian Front was able to be more insidious and was more in turn exterminationist, which is disturbing, when they were forced underground in 1943. The speech could not be monitored as the organization went underground, and consequently, I think the benefit of free speech is that it can be open to the public and viewable.
Now, I want to be clear, Joan Donovan, free speech as in First Amendment doesn't necessarily apply to a private company owned by one person. But this breeding ground for hate, inability to track it, on the 17th, per NPR on the 17th of November, the first round of cuts at Twitter slashed 15% of their trust and safety employees. That was the first round of cuts. Mm-hmm. So take us to where we might be headed.
Yeah, I don't particularly think that when these infrastructures that allow for hate to spread in such massive volume that you are attracting and recruiting lots of new people to these movements, I don't think it's a bad thing. And our research shows it's not a bad thing if these networks are disrupted in some ways, particularly the networks that do bring resources in. So it's not just that people are communicating on these networks, but as Ari was alluding to, movements, whether they're far right or left wing, they use these tools like Twitter specifically to drive resources and drive people from what our book on meme wars that came out in September alludes to, which is from the wires to the weeds. People are moving from these ideas and these mobilized online and into the streets, and they're doing and behaving in different ways. And, you know, we have all these correlates now between accounts that are against LGBTQ folks and then bomb threats at Boston Children's Hospital, right? There's a lot of anti-trans propaganda flowing through Twitter right now, and it's directly showing up in people's lives. And even if it wasn't producing bomb threats, what else it's producing is that doctors are afraid to provide this kind of care, gender-affirming care now. And so there's a lot going on. And I think, you know, the invitation to bring Trump back to this platform is also in a lot of ways anti-democratic, which is something that when we look much more closely at movements that are anti-establishment, especially the last large manifestation of MAGA that was, you know, an attempt to overthrow the Capitol, that kind of talk online directly incites people to do these large-scale violent actions. And so we might not be looking at this one-to-one correlation between what was going on in the 40s and now, but rather the challenge right now is to figure out, well, what kind of guardrails can regulators put on social media companies so that this doesn't get further and further out of control?
We're talking about the implications of the leadership choices Elon Musk has made since he took over Twitter. We've been speaking with Joan Donovan. We're also talking with Ari Waldman, and the implications and how that will reverberate here as well as elsewhere. So, Ari, I'm going to turn back to you. I'm going to play a little sound from Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray talking to us on Radio Boston about Twitter last week.
I'm an Elon Musk fan. I don't think there's any question that in 50 years, he's going to be looked at the way we look at Henry Ford or Bill Gates. But that doesn't mean he's perfect, not by any means. He clearly does not know what he's doing at Twitter. It's just been a hot mess.
Ari, I've been intrigued by the leadership dimension of this because people keep saying it's nonsensical, he's messing up. I'm not in his head. From a leadership standpoint, is it possible that he's doing exactly what he wants to be doing? And there is no mess up here happening at all?
Well, if his goal is to, ruin the company, that's he's doing exactly what he's doing. He's taking steps that would exactly lead to that. I'm not sure that we want to. And I'm not sure someone who thinks that what Elon Musk is doing is a good thing wants to compare him to Henry Ford, who was a Nazi sympathizer.
Well, I do want to be clear that Hiawatha Bray didn't say what he was doing at Twitter was a good thing. I do want to be clear about that. But go ahead.
Sure. So it's hard to, obviously we're not in his head. I think Joan is right that that he has for a long time been anti-media, but he's not, what he's doing here is taking all the steps that one would take to dismantle a company step by step, but at the same time also exposing himself to incredible liability. So you know, if you dismantle the content moderation team, sure, you have protections from Communications Decency Act Section 230, which is a federal law that immunizes platforms from lawsuits associated with the choices you make when you moderate content. But on the other hand, when you dismantle the privacy team, the trust and safety team, the security team, you're setting yourself up for investigations by the FTC, by the DOJ, by other government regulators that are now it's now relatively easy to, would be relatively easy to find out if Twitter is no longer in compliance with consent decrees or no longer in compliance with applicable laws. So if this is something that is, you know, some grand plan of his to run the company into the ground, he's doing so while exposing him and his investors to great liability.
So, Joan Donovan, I'm mindful of a tweet I saw over the weekend from Sue O'Connell, who's at NBC Boston. And it was from a picture that had been posted of Musk and several of the people who had responded to his call to show up at headquarters in San Francisco on Friday. It seems like to do coding. It is in the picture what appears to be an all-male room with him. And O'Connell says, "Don't worry your pretty little heads, ladies. The men who can or must work hardcore have this handled. I'm sure your concerns will be considered." What about representation in a company as powerful as this one?
Yeah, I mean, engineering culture is very different. Obviously, there's many, many pipeline issues educationally with getting women into engineering. Particularly in these highly competitive fields. I was at Twitter about 2 weeks before Musk acquired it, and the mood there was very solemn. I had lunch in the cafeteria with a couple of colleagues, and I had been brought in to talk about my book to the machine learning and ethics team, which was one of the first teams that he disbanded. And I think Twitter, you know, as it changes and as he gets lean and mean with the corporate structure, it's going to show up in the product. The product is not going to have as many guardrails in terms of spam and making sure that people don't see pornography and these kinds of things. But it's also going to get more dangerous, I think, for women as, you know, things that don't go away are things like trolling and brigading and, you know, even Kanye's first tweet, Shalom, that he came back with was meant to troll. So I don't think, you know, we're going to get the best out of this new arrangement.
All right. Joan Donovan is the research director of the Harvard Kennedy School Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Ari Waldman is a professor of law and computer science at Northeastern and the faculty director of the university's Center for Law, Information, and Creativity. Appreciate you both helping us sort of clarify the picture here. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.